That's a great question. And when I spent some time with Rand Pecknold this year prior to the tournament, he said to me that this team was built to beat Canada.
Welcome to Mother Puckers, the first and only podcast for hockey moms by a hockey mom. And that's me, Julie Bardowski. Hello, episode 60. We're 3 weeks into this resurgence of Mother Puckers. I know you might note that my voice is a little bit scratchy, tired sounding. And let me put it to you this way. It was a long, fun weekend in Chicago for hockey. My college roommate, one of my BFFs, came and saw a game. Got to hang out with her and her family a little bit. Super fun. And then 4 hours. It's only 4 hours from Michigan to Chicago, from Michigan to Pittsburgh, 2 hours to Cleveland. It's so nice because all the places we need to go are really simple drives. There's not planes and trains and automobiles. It's just packing the car up, and granted, we do look like the Griswolds from Family Vacation because there's stuff on top, there's stuff on back, there's dogs inside. It's just insane. And so when we're traveling along, you know that we're a hockey fan. You know, or it's one of those, tell me you're a hockey family without telling me you're a hockey family, and you just have to take a look at our car on the weekend, and there you have it. So that was fun. We had a good weekend, saw some good players. Man, I tell you, a couple of kids on Windy City 16U and on Mission, really, really talented players. So it's fun to watch them. I know we're in our middle of the season right now, January, mid-January. You get the mid-January, you know, itchies. You know, there's a season almost over. Am I meeting my goals? I'm a little banged up. I'm a little tired. My muscles are a little sore. Well, stretch. Hydrate, treat your body well, get your rest as much as you can. I know a bunch of these kids right now are headed into finals, and that's always a tough week as well while you're managing and juggling hockey. But these are the things that being a youth athlete really helps carry you on forward in your world, because these are the things of life. Because here I am, got back late last night, but made it back in time for the All-American USA Hockey game at USA Hockey Arena back in Plymouth. So we put the pedal to the metal, and the hockey dad husband here got us back and got to watch Team Blue beat Team White. These are the 2023 draft eligible players. So when you walk in, all you see is a wall of black clad men. Because apparently that's the uniform for hockey scouts. There were 200 to 300 hockey scouts in the building last night, and every NHL scout, every D1, D3, you name it, every juniors team, everybody had a representative there watching these kids, and it was quite electric seeing the atmosphere, feeling the energy, watching the game. Saw a little bit of everything, saw some back and forth, but then we saw Team Blue pull away. We saw a great penalty shot was made. I mean, you can find all of that, but this is something, you young mamas of youngers, that's something for them to watch because it was on the NHL Network. They were all set up there in the corner, and something you can go back and see, I'm sure, but these are mostly 18-year-olds that will be names being picked in the NHL draft this summer. So it is definitely something to keep an eye on with these kids here. And these are the top U.S. kids. And I also kind of realized as we were walking around the arena last night, you know, we've been in travel hockey. This is our 9th season. How does it go so fast? 9th season? 8th season. 8th season of travel hockey. Sorry. Oh, I'm aging myself and my child a year. And it's amazing when you're in it for that long and you're traveling around, because when you're in a non-traditional market, you're having to go everywhere, right? And we were walking around the arena and we would just go a few feet, see someone we knew and stop and talk, go a few more feet, see someone else we knew and stop and talk. And it was kind of that way all the way around. And the the ushers, God bless them, just kept telling us, quit blocking the aisles. And we're like, oh, we're sorry. But so that's either as long as we've been in hockey or just represents how much we've traveled in hockey. I don't know which, but it was fun. In Chicago this weekend, I do want to give a shout out. I'm going to go back here for a second. I was on the elevator talking to a few hockey moms. I mentioned Mother Puckers, and one of them said, I thought that was you because I had Dave, Diamond David Lee Ruff, with me. Because Diamond Dave and I were staying at a Hilton, which is a pet-friendly hotel, because our team was staying at a Marriott, which is a non-pet-friendly hotel. And so in order to see my kid play, take care of my dog, Dave and I had a nice little romantic weekend away in the Embassy Suites there. And the fur ball got lots of attention from all the kids because there were a ton of younger players there. I want to give a shout out to the Afton Americans. You kids were super friendly in letting me take the picture, which will be posted on my social media account. And to the mom who knew who I was, knew who Dave was, and gave her condolences about losing Eddie. I love meeting the listeners live and in person. There goes my voice again. So yes, it was a good solid weekend going back to how my own youth sporting career has kept me going forward. So we did the Chicago, we did the All-American game, and today I'm getting on a plane to go to Park City. So I'm recording this really early in the morning before I head off for work, and I'll share some of that adventure next week. I'll be there for the week, and then when I get back, we turn around and head to Cleveland, which is only a couple of hours away, but another hockey weekend away, and it's cool. It's cool. We're built for this. We can do this, mamas. Let me do a few of the commercials here. I would love it if you would go and like, subscribe, share, rate the episode at the end of it. Mother Puckers, MUTHERPUCKERS. A little bit different, but that's because that you is what's holding the libation that gets you through being a hockey mom. I look forward to seeing those DMs that you've been sending me since I've been back. Keep them coming. Keep on the topics that you want. I want to congratulate our Team Canada friends for the women's gold and the men's gold in the World Juniors. And I want to congratulate our Team USA, both with bronzes. And I mean, I just can't get over the fact in that Team Canada game, the hat trick in the first period. I mean, how do you do that? Caitlin Kramer, that's insane. So congratulations to Team Canada on both your golds, but we're going to get into Team USA and World Juniors, the genesis of it. We're going to talk with a man who's going to join us for the next few episodes because he just has so much knowledge and been around USA Hockey. He was a 30-year volunteer, scout, and consultant. He was part of the structure that brought the Team USA their first gold in World Juniors in 2004. You may remember Lou Mangialuzzo, NHL scout, longtime NHL scout, from episode 44 of Mother Puckers, and he shared top 10 things that have changed in the sport. So Lou brings such a depth and knowledge with him. I wanted to have him as part of talking with some of these amazing guests. And along with all of that history that he brings with him, he brought his good friend Dave Starman to join the conversation. There's a lot more detail on Dave in the interview as far as an intro for him. But for now, I do want to keep you to keep in mind that he was, at that time, the youngest head coach in CHL history in 2000 when he took over the Memphis River Kings. And if you see the promo visuals that I shared out there, you will be able to check out how convincingly he wore his facial hair back then. He had so much confidence in his beard that he knew that gum wouldn't even dare stick to it. So that's impressive. Other than that, Dave is one of the most respected college hockey analysts in the country. There's not much that gets by him when you're having a conversation, and I think he gets that from the years he spent playing hockey as a goaltender. Dave tended for University of Hartford. We all know that goalies are special, and Dave fits the mold and brings his expertise to all of you. So let's turn that conversation over to Dave Starman and Lou Mangialuzzo and talk about Team USA World Juniors. Today, I get to talk to two individuals who have so much rich history with USA Hockey and World Juniors that you're going to be getting a front seat for the recap of this year's World Juniors that just finished last week with Canada taking the gold in Halifax. First, we have Lou Mangialuzzo. You'll remember Lou from episode 44. Go back, take a listen. Fun conversation we had there. Lou has over 30 years of service to USA Hockey as a volunteer, consultant, and scout. He was part of the team that brought Team USA the first World Juniors gold in 1994. I even got to try his ring on. Outside of the USA hockey world, Lou has a long tenure as an NHL scout with the Nordiques, the Senators, and now the New Jersey Devils. Prior to that, Lou was in the college coaching ranks with RPI, Colgate, and Princeton, and he just got back from the 100th anniversary of the Hobie Baker rink at Princeton this past weekend. He's also the last standing AOL user out there. So if you're all wondering who still has an AOL address, it's Lou. And Lou, honestly, talking to you as much as I talk to you, I think of you as the hockey apostle. I mean, Lou, with all the knowledge that you have, you are the hockey apostle.
Well, if you're anointing me that, that's fine. But I was thinking, I feel as old as an apostle. As long as it's not Judas, I'm in good shape. You know,
so. Well, if they knew you, that might be the better name then. That's great. We'll just call you the 13th apostle then. No, it's true. But Lou, you know, you reached out to your longtime friend, Dave Starman, who, you know, is here to help give a great recap of this year's World's Juniors. Many of you, myself included, are extremely familiar with Dave from his work from CBS Sports and as the college analyst for CBS for 20 years, been the analyst for Team USA at the World Juniors, and I'm giving a very abbreviated overview. It's rich in history. He has NHL scouting in the background with Toronto and Montreal. He's got a stint with Seattle Kraken. Dave's had stops in Memphis with the River Kings, the New York Junior Bobcats, and my newly favorite named team, the Macon Whoopee. We're going to have to talk about that because I want to know who gave that name because they're one of my new favorite people. But first, you know, we really can't talk about USA Hockey without bringing up Jim Johansson, two-time Olympian and father was the GM of that Miracle team. And I would love to have Lou and Dave, you know, remember him as it's been almost 5 years since he passed away. So Lou, give us some of your memories.
Well, I mean, obviously we both know him fairly well. You know, for me, I think Dave would agree. I mean, no bigger company man. Right. And then JJ, just 365 days a year, you know, 7 days a week. The guy just lived and breathed USA Hockey. And I mean, I think Dave knows it too. Like he's in office meeting one day, traveling to Vienna or Europe, and next day he's putting sticks on the bus for the junior team or the world championship team, you know, under the bus. Like he did it all, we'll really miss him and everybody misses him. And I think, you know, one thing I will say, I think one of the biggest credits to him is we always had, is that Dave would know, we always had trouble getting players for the world championship because of the NHL. Some guys wouldn't want to go and whatever. But he really, over the years, really with the time we had Ann Arbor and then going through World Juniors, he really connected with these players. And when it came time, it was they got older to play in the world championship, they said yes. And that's the biggest thing for me. That's the biggest thing. He really went out of his way and really put it all together. I think that's one of the best things I remember about him. Like, if it wasn't for him, half those guys would have just been on the beach. They'd have played golf. They'd have never gone over there in May or whatever. So, for me, that's the thing I remember most myself.
Wow. I love hearing that, you know, because it's always the best leaders who are the ones who will do any job that needs to be done.
You know what's funny about JJ and Lou, you touched on it. Some of my greatest memories are getting to the World Junior Evaluation Camp in December, 2 or 3 weeks before the tournament would start. And it seemed like every year something was missing. Like one year the jerseys didn't come in, one year socks didn't come in, one year sticks were missing, and he's out there running around, you know, either trying to buy towels or find socks real quick that he can get overnighted or get stuff into the dressing room the best that he can. Like, you're right about the fact that he was so hands-on. To me, he embodied what leadership really was, because there was no job too big, no job too small, and no ego whatsoever. And just the warmth that he had, the affection that he had for the people that he worked with and worked around, and that caretaker mentality to make sure that everything was okay for everybody within the fold, to me, is one of my lasting memories of him. He's missed every day. There's not a World Junior that goes by where I don't think of him. And I remember when I did my first one way back in 2009, it was him that set up every player interview for me when I got to Lake Placid. Like, he said to me, gave me a time sheet, and he said, here's everybody on the team in 10-minute intervals in the lounge at the Olympic Training Center. Have at it. They're all yours. Like, that's without even asking. And like, acts like that have never been repeated. And that's why that man just amazed me.
Wow. I wish I had gotten to know him. That sounds like quite a guy. And do you think that, I love that, you know, he built such relationships with the players, so it made it easy for them to say yes to come play with them. We're going to talk about this, you know, selection process and evaluation and everything in a little bit. But do you think today is a more difficult environment to build those relationships due to all the movement of the players and the changes in executive leadership, you know, across USA Hockey?
It's a good question. I think that relationship building is a little tougher now because interpersonal communication, while we're living in a communications world with so many different ways that you get in touch with people, I think the handshake, the face-to-face meeting has gotten away from us a little bit. It's funny, when I went out to the World Junior Evaluation Camp this year, I went in just for a day just to go talk to a couple of people, and, like, you know, a couple of guys laughed at me, like, you know, you could do this on Zoom. And I said, you know, there's not a lot to me that's old fashioned, but that is. And there are times where just being face to face with somebody, even if it's for a couple hours, is well worth the effort. And I, you know, he was a master at that. And I do think that with the change throughout USA Hockey, with changes that have happened throughout the amateur hockey world and the pro hockey world and demands on people's time and that kind of thing, it's probably not as easy to do what he did. But on the other hand, I do think that there are a lot of players out there that, given the opportunity, and they might not be the highest of the high-end guys. It depends on what pool you're choosing from and who's in the playoffs and who's not. But there seems to be a general feeling that if you could put on that USA sweater at least once in your career, and if it's in the World Championships, great. A lot of those guys would be willing to do it at least once.
Wow. Well, hopefully face-to-face does not go the way of AOL and Lou is the last person supporting it.
Yes.
So, Lou, give us just a little bit of rundown of what's going on with the Devils, just for a minute, and then we'll jump into World Juniors.
You know, Dave follows the Devils too, I'm sure. I think that, you know, we're young, obviously. Everybody knows that. I think Dave Blitzer and Josh Harris's vision for the team's been good. I think we've made some good trades, slowly, patiently. You're in their cap system. We've got some young kids. I think that, you know, Kate Madigan's, you know, has been moved up now. She's AGM. She's an articulate young woman who's very bright. I've known her dad, as Dave's known Jimmy Madigan for 30 years or whatever. You know, we have Megan Duggan with us now, is in development. She's terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, she's like being around her is good. She's got a great sense of humor. Both those young women, nothing rolls off. They rolls right off their back. They just go with the flow. The farm team was pretty good last year, and they're not quite as good this year, struggling a little bit. But at the same time, Dan McKinnon is your AGM there as well. I mean, we're just, the organization's moving forward. We got a lot of young kids, obviously.
Well, you have Luke Hughes. He had a fairly good showing there in Halifax.
He's coming out, and, you know, this year, obviously. Dave knows Jimmy Hughes. We all know his dad, and we know Ellen. So, I think we're young and patient. We're doing good now. We got we're away on the road for five, and then we got a really tough March. So, but we're moving forward. I think Dave sees us enough too. He probably has a pretty good view of it.
Yeah, no, I it was great watching that long run, and I the biggest thing for me with the Devils is how well coached they are. Like, I just have the ultimate respect for Lindy Ruff, and I'll never forget this great story. This is why I enjoy Lindy a lot. I was an avid student at Roger Nielsen's coaching clinics for years and years when I was a young coach and a young pro coach. And Roger told a great story about when Lindy Ruff got his first head coaching job. Roger said, "I got someplace I want to take you to help you get you started." And Lindy wasn't exactly sure where it was going, but he thought it was going to be a little different than the trip. And Roger took him to Staples and got him file cabinets and folders and colored pens and labels and all that kind of stuff and binders, and said, this is how you become a head coach. You get extremely organized. And I always think, whenever I think of Lindy Ruff, the first thing that comes to mind is organization and structure. And everywhere he's gone, you see the success.
Well, I'm a big proponent of planning and structure myself, so I'd get right along there. That's great.
Hey, it's not as Dave knows. I mean, this is not an easy job coaching these guys today, right, Dave? I mean, this is it's a little different animal than it was 30, 40 years ago.
To me, one of the biggest difference that I've noticed as I've gone through this, and again, I was a kid when kind of the old days were in place where the teams really held the players over a barrel, and it was a little bit of a different structure. Like now, to me, the most important person in the player's life is probably his agent. Whereas way back when, I think the most important person in the player's life was the coach. And when you get the majority of players making more money than the coach, I think it creates a different dynamic than it did way back when. So I think these coaches today, you can't yell and scream anymore. It doesn't really work. And you've got to treat people a little bit differently. And there's different leverage that, you know, both players have and organizations have in different ways. But it's just not the same as it was, you know, when I was a kid. Like when Al Arbor ran the ship for the Islanders, that was Al's ship. And the buck stopped at Al, and then after that, the buck stopped at Bill Torrey, and it was wonderful to grow up watching that dynamic because you learned a lot doing it. And then to befriend those people later on in my career, it was remarkable the life lessons you learned. But you know, the Scotty Bowmans, the Al Arbors, the Mike Keenans, I think that style of coaching is the authoritarian style is probably out the window. But I think today's coaches are kind of a modern marvel with their ability to be a CEO. Mm-hmm. At the same time as being a father figure to a lot of the younger players.
You know, you mentioned over the barrel. I don't know. The story I remember, and being Julie, the St. Louis Blues, I think their farm team was Salt Lake. Was it not, Dave?
You're right. We're the Salt Lake Golden Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I remember Doug Pelizzari telling me a story about Purina owned the team, right, Julie? Didn't they own the team? In St. Louis, the Blues?
Way back when.
Yep. Right. Okay, well, back then, Doug was a pretty good player. He was a top player in Utah there, okay? And I think they what's the old GM, Dave?
Ron Caron
came to him and said, "You can stay with us and make a little less money, or you can go expansion." Or he said, "No, I want to leave." And you know what? When he said that, I hate to say it, he went down to Salt Lake. He never came back. They looked at it almost like it's disloyal, like in a way. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's a total different animal now. So.
Yeah, but flexibility. I mean, that's pretty much anywhere in the world with, you know, having to modernize all of our thinking and reactions, right?
Yes.
So if we're looking at, you know, World Juniors, and it just happened, and I know everybody's talking about it. I know the Twitterverse has been on fire with obviously some of those refereeing calls. But give us, Dave, you were there. Tell us what was it like? How was it being in the normal time and in person?
The World Juniors is one of the most unique experiences that you can go through. And it's like, I've experienced them now in a couple of different ways. I've done them in Canada where it's off the charts. I mean, like, I try to explain it to people. It's like, it's March Madness, but on steroids, because it's national pride, not school pride. It's a whole different story. And in Canada, this tournament is something that you literally have to be up there to understand and appreciate. And I'm not quite sure I could draw a parallel of anything here in the U.S. So that's number one. So, and then, you know, I've had a couple that have been in bigger cities, whether it be like Ottawa or Buffalo, Toronto, Montreal. I mean, those have been great, but the best experience I ever had at the World Juniors was in Saskatoon in 2010, because the building was maybe 9,000, 10,000 people. It was packed for almost every game, even if the U.S. and Canada weren't playing. Canada was going for six in a row. The U.S. pulled off that big upset on the overtime goal by John Carlson. So it's really unique to watch these kids. I mean, and people forget they're kids, but it's really unique to watch these kids try to muster up the energy emotionally, mentally, physically, to play seven games in 12 days in front of the brightest lights in the hockey world, in front of the entire hockey watching world, in front of NHL GMs, AGMs, head scouts, player development guys that are all in the building, and just to try to function as normal players and try to play it as a game and not as an event. And that to me is where it's really unique. And you know, this year, I thought this year's tournament was good. Like to me, it wasn't one that stands out among some of the other ones. I'd kind of put it right in the middle in terms of the amount of great games we saw. But I'll tell you what, the players and the skill level that you see at that tournament are unbelievable. I mean, it's amazing to watch how good these guys are at 18 and 19, and in some cases, 17.
Yeah, when you go back to like when Lou was there for 2004 compared to 2023, you know, we're 19 years difference. What are the biggest differences in the game that you're seeing?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think the biggest difference that you're seeing right now from the time that Lou's team won gold to now is when that team won the gold medal, everybody was pleasantly surprised. When the U.S. won the gold medal in 2021, everybody thought that, well, yeah, they should have. And when they don't win a gold medal, people are stunned and shocked and PO'd, and it's gold medal or bust now. And when Lou was running things back then, the U.S. generally had enough good players for one really good team and probably didn't leave a whole lot of film on the cutting room floor in terms of players they didn't take. Now, the U.S. probably could put two teams into the World Junior Tournament, and the B team probably would threaten to medal just as much as the A team. And that, to me, is the biggest difference in the World Juniors right now, is the fact that over the last, well, let's go since 2004, so 20 World Juniors, the amount of improvement and ground covered by the United States as a federation, and I believe a lot of it has to do with the launching of the American Development Model, which has increased skill level of a lot of our young players, has increased the retention rate of a lot of our young players to stay in the game, and by all means has certainly increased the depth pool of how many players are producing in 13 different districts.
Yeah, Dave, Julie, I have to tell you, it's almost like it's, you know, I'm a proud American. We all are. I it's like it's growing up with Jersey, Philadelphia, Long Island hockey. Like, we arrived 20 years ago, right, Dave? Like, there isn't anywhere our kids can't go from the Mid-Atlantic. We can go anywhere in the world and beat somebody. Would you not agree? I mean, right?
No, I would completely agree. Like, there's an old saying, Lou, we have in the scouting community, you find me a non-grassroots area whose team wins the Stanley Cup, and then you go back there 20 years later, and you're literally mining for gold. And it happened in Pittsburgh. It happened on Long Island. It's happened in the Carolinas. You're seeing it in Florida. You're seeing it in Dallas. It's amazing to see what has happened. You get a lot of former players that sometimes settle into these communities and lend their expertise to help programs get started. They bring the game and the culture with them. But Lou's right. I mean, when you think about it 20, 25 years ago, I mean, our area, Long Island, New Jersey, Western and Eastern Pennsylvania, I mean, they were producing players, but not to the extent that they have as the years have continued to go on. And there was, I mean, 5 years ago when we won the gold medal in 2017, I think there were five Long Island kids on that team.
Oh, and Dave, let me just say on that, like, we've had, you know, we have a little summer event, as you know, the Liberty Bell games, which your son played in, and Julie certainly knows a lot about it now. I mean, we've had I think, two or three kids every year on the World Junior team. Like, UFCO was at it. I mean, we've had tons of kids. So I agree with 1,000%. Absolutely.
Yeah, the growth, I think, between the Miracle team, which only had four states in the United States represented on the Miracle team, to what was represented on the ice in Beijing, is 20 states were represented. I think that's the correct
number. Oh, is that what it was? Wow, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention one thing. We were talking about all this, the grassroots and the kids coming from everywhere. I was with Tony Horchek a few years back at a conference, and I was speaking, and a parent asked me, well, what about the cream rises to the top? You know, the old, obviously it's a famous phrase, right? You know what I mean? Cliche. And I said, yeah, but the thing is, but the cream's everywhere now. I mean, it's everywhere. It's Arizona. It's California. Like, it's not like it's three states or two areas of the country or three areas of the country. But yeah, the cream rises to the top. The problem is it's all over the place. Like, it's hard to track it all down. It's tough to cover, right, in every aspect. I mean, Dave sees that with just doing college hockey in general, where these kids come from now, right?
No question. I mean, these kids are coming from all over the place. Like, way back, you think back 80, 84, 88, it was mostly Minnesota and Massachusetts kids, and then you get a sprinkling of the Michigan kids. Now, then all of a sudden, Michigan exploded, and they started to produce some of the elite players that we're seeing in the game. Then New York started to jump into the mix. Illinois jumped into the mix. So now you had five states going, and you know, then the rest of New England started to jump in. Then the Mid-Atlantic district started to jump in, and all of a sudden you got players coming from all over the place, and that was the best part about it. But I think that what's happening now is you're getting a lot of players from different areas of the country with a lot of these academy teams and a lot of these programs that are coming up all over the place. You're finding really good hockey throughout a lot of the different districts because of the fact that people that are coming from the grassroots areas are starting to establish programs in the more non-traditional areas because it's easy to recruit. Players want to go to some of these different areas, and that has helped the growth of the game because all of a sudden, like, you look to the Carolinas and Georgia and areas like that. I mean, there's youth programs going on all over the place. And, you know, I think back to the late Bob McCaig. When I was with the Atlanta Knights in the mid-90s, you know, I helped Bob McCaig start what has become Atlanta Youth Hockey. And it's awesome to see what's going on down there because, I mean, now they got a ton of teams playing down there. They got a lot of good ones. And I think back to the mid-90s when, you know, there was one youth hockey organization in the state of Georgia, and it's continued to grow. And even when I went with the Macon Whoopee, I mean, we created a youth league down there and a men's league down there. So we had four youth teams and we had four men's league teams that were all playing games on off nights at the Macon Coliseum. And, I mean, that's how this game grows, is because we brought the culture with us. And our passion for the game helped spread the news that this was a game worth playing.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we come from a non-traditional market out of Nashville, and my son actually played for TPH, so he was with Thunder out of Alabama. So we have a lot of experience with hockey in the South, and it is amazing how much it has exploded. We need more rinks, so we've got to figure out the answer to that problem and how we make it more affordable for kids to play so that we continue to grow the greatest sport out there.
I'll give you a great example. In Nashville right now, and playing for the Nashville Junior Predators at 18U is a kid by the name of Charles Day. Charles Day was born in Hawaii, and his grandfather is the former owner of the Islanders. And he picked up the game, obviously, through his family, and his dad is Chris Day, and was a huge hockey guy, and was a president of the Islanders for a while, and, you know, through Charles Wong and his father, Charles fell in love with the game and was around the Islanders all the time. So obviously there was that, you know, that natural rub off, but Charles became a pretty good player, and, you know, we called him the Flying Hawaiian when he played for us here on Long Island. But I mean, here's a Hawaiian-born player that's playing 18U and has a pretty good chance to play college hockey.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, you got to know Carlos then down there at the coach. He's great.
Yeah, they love the program. I mean, that Nashville Junior Predators program has really taken off.
Yeah. Yep, they really are. I think they've got a couple of college commits. A very good friend of mine's son is playing for the Maryland Black Bears right now. So, yeah, there are really some good kids coming out of the South. It's really fun. So if we go back to World Juniors for a minute, tell us a little bit about some of the best players that were in the tournament. I mean, hello, we all know the one name that everybody's been talking about and everybody thinking he's going to be heading to Phoenix. Who knows? But let's talk about it. Who are some of the favorite players that you had right in your eyesight?
Well, I'll tell you what, the goaltender from Slovakia, the kid who played in the North American League for a long time, Guyon, who's going to play at the University of Minnesota Duluth, I mean, that kid, to me, stole the show. I get this feeling, and Luke, correct me if I'm wrong, it just seems like every year at the World Junior Tournament, there's a goaltender for a team that's a little under the radar that comes in and just writes this incredible story, like Suharic did last year for the Czechs and Guyon for the Slovaks. And a couple of years ago, there's a kid from Switzerland that turned the world on its ear. It just seems like, you know, that's been a common theme. So that kid really caught your eye. And, you know, obviously Connor Bedard was the guy that everybody talked about. And Shane Wright had a great tournament. And I love the way Joshua Wall played for Canada, too. I thought he was terrific in a couple of different roles that he played. And then you look at the U.S. and we talk about Long Island kids. I mean, Ryan Ufko from University of Massachusetts, he's a Smithtown, New York kid. And he wrote an incredible story, you know, among a defense corps that had a national champion on it, and Sean Behrens and Luke Hughes, who was a fourth overall pick in the draft. This kid Ufko was terrific, and you know, Lou. It seems like this tournament has got a way of finding a name that nobody connected with just yet, and all of a sudden they write an incredible script over seven games.
Well, you know what? You get the chance to get your moment in the sun, and some kids make the best of it. And some don't, right? So, but I mean, on the goalie thing, I being removed from it for quite a while now, I run into hockey fans that watch the tournament, and they'll bring up your point about the Slovak goalie, and I really don't know because I'm so removed from it. But it seems like every couple of years, there's some guy that comes out of nowhere, and it's on everybody's lips. He could be from the Slovaks. He could be Czech. He could be anywhere. It's just amazing. And there's been a lot of it. And there's been some Russians that have done that, too. So, no, it's so true. I agree 100%. You know?
Well, you know, so, Lou, that's like, that's spot on because there are kids that are watched since they're, you know, 8 years old because they're the early maturers. But by the time you get to the, you know, the U20, things are evening out so much. And then the late bloomers are really starting to come up. So does that seem to be the case with these kids that you're suddenly noticing that you hadn't before? Were they all late bloomers or just, you know, under the radar?
I think to be honest with you, you never know. And I go back to the movie Moneyball, and where Russ comes in at the end of the movie and he says, Billy, I want to talk to you. And Billy says, what's up, Russ? He says, oh, you got Google Boy in here from Yale telling us what to do. And we've been doing this in baseball 150 years. And I think Billy says to him, well, you know, Russ, I've seen you at dining room table with these parents projecting these kids, how much money they're going to make. And the fact of it is, you don't know. And I don't know either. Nobody knows. And the reason nobody knows is because we're a free culture that we can do anything we want, right? We're all over the place. So there's time, moments in time that change everything, you know? So some kids stay on the path, some don't. Are there some late bloomers? Yeah. Are there some kids on the radar? Yeah. I just think it's a mixed bag. I don't have the recipe. I really don't. I think a lot of it has to do with timing and you know, who's at the game, when the kid plays. And I mean, I'm not a big football guy, but Dave probably follows it more than me. Drew Bledsoe got hurt, right? If he don't get hurt, how long do you think before he would have heard of Tom Brady?
Oh, right. Well, there's a lot of those cases.
Point?
Yep, very fair point. Mm-hmm. Anything can happen. You got to be ready to take your chance, right?
Quarterbacks play backup. Steve Young was a backup for 9 years, right? Like to Joe Montana. So it's opportunity, under the radar, late bloomers. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. So,
Dave, do you think that the U.S. have helped themselves in the selection process? Do you think that they have the ability to recognize the late bloomers and who's going to pop during the World Juniors?
I would say this. I do believe in the late bloomer. I'm a big fan of the late bloomer. And I would tell you that if my 05 makes it to where he wants to go, he'll be more in that late bloomer category. And it's been a great watch in doing it. I don't think the World Juniors is as late bloomer heavy as we might think it is, because the kids that are playing in that tournament are the top 5% of their birth year straight across. And those kids, the majority of them were the early matriculators. And then you get a couple that might have been a little off the radar that jumped in. And I think that the majority of the players, especially from the U.S. side, I think they probably identified a good chunk of these players from the time that they were probably around 15 or 16 as legitimate candidates to eventually make this team. Now, there have been times where the U.S. has brought players to the summer eval camp and they looked great. And then they went back and played their first semester with their college team or the first half of the season with their junior team, and they were awful. Then there have been times where there have been guys that weren't even invited to the camp that played their way onto the roster because of how good they played, or how well they played, I should say, in the first half of the season with their respective teams. So it's, as Lou said, it's not a perfect process. It's really hard to judge. I don't think that the evaluators for whether it be the U.S. or Canada or Sweden or Finland or, you know, any of the big countries, I don't think they make a lot of mistakes, but you can make a case. There's probably one player every year that comes in and you say to yourself, well, you know what? I'm not quite sure where this player made it onto this team. Real good player, but I'm not quite sure he was ready for this.
Yeah, I agree. I think Dave's right about that. We talked late bloomer, I think more pro, because that's what I'm doing for the longest time now. They know 95% of what they want. They really do. And it all comes down to who performs on that night. As Art Bergen would say, you go overseas and there's three guys you bring. You're surprised they play as well as you did. And there's three guys you bring and you're disappointed, right?
Yep.
It's just, it evolves to, and on that stage, as Dave said, there's pressure after, you know what, it's everybody's tight. I think they are. I mean, I can tell you, you can tell it's tough. It's a tough term.
Are they looking at players to play a certain type of game against the world so that they can bring them in? And does that have a lot of weight into who they choose?
That's a great question. And when I spent some time with Rand Pecknold this year prior to the tournament, he said to me that this team was built to beat Canada because they figured if they were going to win a gold medal, they were either going to have to beat Canada in the gold medal game or knock them out along the way. So their entire game plan and methodology and the way that they picked the team and the personnel that they were looking at were all designed with the intention of this would be the team that in a 60-minute game could knock out the Canadians and either win gold or get them into a gold medal game. Now, obviously, it didn't happen, and there were a couple little bumps along the way in that game, but there's no question that when these teams get picked, when the U.S. team gets picked, they probably look at the field and say, outside of us, and this is kind of a cool thing. I think the U.S. looks at it and says, outside of us, the best team we're going to play is probably going to be the Canadians. And that in itself is a remarkable statement from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think that they look at it and say, if we don't gear ourselves up to beat Canada, then we're not building the right team. So I do think that personnel that they identify is based purely on winning that game.
If Connor Bedard, go ahead, Lou.
I'm sorry. I went to chime in. It's so interesting. I don't make a lot of friends a lot of places I go sometimes. So, you know, it's become the norm the last 30 years. But I remember when Lou Barrow, Mike Hastings and Ronnie Ralston, we're in Halifax, I think, Halifax, and Alan Adams, who worked for the Hockey News, Dave, you know him, right? Okay, right?
Yep.
And I think his son was the stick boy for Team Canada. And we were in Halifax, and we brought Matt Green, okay? And at the press conference, he made a point to say, well, Matt Green, you know, he's a lumbering guy, like he didn't look too good against the Slovaks. Tongue in cheek, I almost laughed at him. We didn't bring Matt Green to play against the Slovaks, dude. We brought Matt Green to play against the Canadians. And when he did, they were terrified. They were truly terrified. I remember, like, he was such a man and a big man, right? You know what I mean? And I remember they had 11 power plays, the R3, okay? We didn't have Holweg. Gleason was hurt, and we lost 3-2. So to Dave's point, yeah, I think we now – look, you got to respect everybody. You can't – there's good teams in this tournament. I mean, the Russians weren't there this year, but they've won a bunch. Canadians have won an awful lot, obviously. Swedes, like, you can get beat by anybody.
Yep.
But, I mean, for me, I think we all agree, like, it's and I think the Canadians feel the same way. It's about playing us, I would think. I think they think that way.
Although I would agree with you 1,000% on that's the way they look at it, too. This year, the U.S. came under a lot of criticism for having a defense corps that was too small. And the question that I get asked a lot is, did they have other options, and why did they pick this seven and that kind of thing? And, you know, I'm not doing amateur scouting anymore, so I'm not really paying attention all that much to what's in the berth here. So I couldn't answer the question as to whether or not we left a lot of big defensemen on the table. But I will tell you this, the one year that the worst year the U.S. has had in recent memory was 2012 in Edmonton. They were in relegation, and they didn't beat Latvia. They were going to the B pool. And that defense corps was huge. And I remember Tim Taylor, the late, great Tim Taylor, sitting next to me in the press box in Edmonton in the middle of the tournament saying to me, well, here's kind of what it comes down to. At the very least, our defensemen are really big, so maybe it'll take people a little bit longer to get around them. So just because we had a big defense didn't mean that we were going to win. And that's why when people are criticizing the small defense as not being able to handle Canada's net front pressure at times, I say to myself, you know, there are times you brought a big defense there too, and they have the same problem.
Yeah, I see that. Like, we both, you know, Julie's been listening to this for a while. Her son's been playing for a while. Like, I listen to all the criticism. You know, it's not easy. It's just not.
We just want to win. Not easy. That's all.
So many things go wrong. Like, yeah. I had the team for 5 years. We lost one. Keith Alain coached the team at 02. He did a great job. You know, we lost one game to Russia. They won the whole thing. Then we go to Halifax. We were a little banged up, you know, there. Then we win it. And then, you know, and then Louis flipped the goalies around to give Jimmy Howard a chance. We lost the bronze. Likens fell down in North Dakota. We lost the bronze. You just never know. The one thing I will say on the point of big defensemen, I mean, some teams in the NHL have a philosophy, never draft a guy under 6 foot, 6'2", whatever. I think it was Louis was talking to me about this, about you need to be strong enough to be able to get to their net and be strong enough to stop them from getting to your net, right? I think that's a fair point, right?
Absolutely.
And I always looked at it kind of that way. It's no good if you're big and you can't get around, but I still think – I listened to some people on TV talking about 18, 19-year-old kids. Last time I looked, it was a 20-year-old tournament, correct?
Yep.
You got to have men.
Yeah, you do. You need a few.
You got to have men. We brought Danny Fritchie in 2004. He was a man, okay? And, you know, great game against Sweden, game winner against Finland, first goal against Canada, because he was a man. And that's what you got. That's what you got to have for the most part, you know, on that. So,
Dave, you mentioned the process of selection has a summer camp and then a decision made in December. Is that right?
That is correct.
And, I mean, still at that age, I mean, granted, I was a late bloomer, so obviously I'm fans of the late bloomer. I grew 3 inches in college, so between the time I was 18 and 22, I grew 3 inches. Do you see a lot of changes in the players from that summer camp to that decision in December?
I do, because I do think that a lot of times the players come in, you don't necessarily know what mental, physical, emotional state they're coming into for what really is summer hockey. You finish your season, you want to try to give your body a break, and you finish up your semester, and you want to have a little downtime, and you want to do some other stuff. But, you know, the bottom line is you're grinding just to get ready for that summer camp. So you're not really giving yourself a break. And once that summer camp ends, you can give yourself a little downtime, but then you're starting to make your push into September to start getting ready for the season. So I think that when the summer camp environment is there, while the intensity is there and the ability to make the team, or at least make a dent in your, you know, for your case to make the team is there, I think your play with your regular club team moving through the first half of the season means a whole lot more, in my opinion, than the summer camp. And it's amazing how many coaches have said to me, we've run the summer camp and had some guys that we didn't even think were going to make the team that wound up in our top six once everything was said and done, because they had a great first half and they came in with more confidence and they came in with a hockey mindset, as opposed to coming to Plymouth in the middle of the summer and thinking about, you know, playing a week and a half and then getting back to the lake.
Do you think that they'd be better to move that into the spring right after the season ends so that they get them right at the end? Or do you think their players would be too beat up for an extra week? Sorry, Lou.
I think they'd be too beat up, right? Lou, I mean, you see it at the pro level.
This is a great conversation. I wish Pat Gallagher could hear this.
We'll send it to him.
Retire now. I tell you, I remember when Doug Pazari asked me to do the job. I can tell you, this is such a great topic. That summer thing, I'm telling you, like, that was really all we had. Okay, so this one, we didn't have any December. I said to Digger and JJ after 2000, or maybe it was 2005, I said, listen, we talked about putting a staff together of American pro guys, Chris Pryor, Timmy Burke, people that were Americans that saw the draft, right, guys? Okay, saw the draft, and over October, November, the first couple weeks of December, we could decide who we thought was good enough, right? There wasn't anybody else. I mean, and the coaches, they're coaching their college teams, right? You know, Louis wasn't, but Keith Elaine was, and then Mike Eaves was, and Scotty Sandlin took the Dean Blaise bowed out because his wife was ill. I mean, but now we have staff, and to be honest with you, I'm for hiring more people. I would put more boots on the ground in October and November. If we have the funds to do it, let's do it. So if not that we're not going to make a mistake, but that summer thing, it's great. But you know what? It's far from New Year's Day, right? Like, to me. So
it started. My personal feeling is it's running its course a little bit. It's a little long, and it's a weird time. I think it's great to get everybody together because you can start to get some of the mental footprint put in terms of what you want to be and what the mindset should be, especially with the guys who you pretty much know are locked into that team. So it gives them something to chew on for the better part of 3 months to get them mentally ready for a 7-game sprint. So, I mean, like, it's got its usage there. But, Lou, I'm with you on more boots on the ground. If I say another word about that topic, I will get myself into more trouble than I could never get out of.
Well, listen, I think they've done a great job. I'm just saying that the summer hockey is it's a good thing, but it's far from December or January.
Yep.
And I think they've matured, they've evolved to where they're doing it correctly. But I don't think you can ever have enough. I mean, geez, I cut Dubinsky. He was a pretty good pro. I cut Nick Foligno. He was a pretty good pro. I mean, you know, I cut the kid there, Backus. I mean, you couldn't get around the guy. Like, there were reasons why really good players got cut. Like, they turned out to be good pros. But it's not the NHL. It's a junior tournament. And for whatever the reason, that's the way it was. But, I think I'm not criticizing them. I just think that it's a short window of 2 months, 2.5 months. You better find out who's good. And you know, and so for me, you know, we went from like one person and a coach trying to figure out and calling, you know, Keith would call coaches, how's your kid playing in college, or Heinze would, or that's no way to go about it. You got to do what they're doing now and continue to do it. And I think they're doing a good job of it, in all honesty, when you think about it.
I would agree. Yep.
Everyone has to look back to Herb Brooks because he did it.
Yes, he did it.
All on the biggest stage. So,
yep, buried the guy like a saint when he died, too.
as they should have. And you know, that brings a question. When do you guys think the Russians are going to be able to come back? I mean, current political and war status aside, when do you guys think Russia's going to be able to come back?
It's a good question. I mean, I'll tell you what, them not being at the World Junior Tournament has an impact because Russia was one of the big five.
Right.
And every year, the pools were set up where you'd have two of the big five on one side and three of the big five on the other side. And the real test was if you were on the side with just two teams, let's say it was just the U.S. and Finland on one side, Canada, Sweden, the Russians on the other, somebody in that pool's got to finish third. And somebody pretty good's going to finish second. And on the other side of the pool there with just the two big ones, your trick was don't fall too low because you're going to have to face a bigger boy as you cross over. You know what I mean? Like it was – so with the Russians in there, it's a little bit of a different story. But without the Russians, I mean, this year, this tournament turned on its head 48 hours into it. I mean, the Finns lost early.
Yep.
Canada lost early. And it took 6 days to righten the ship in many cases. And you can make the case in Canada's pool, it never did because the Czechs finished higher than they were supposed to. So, and you wound up with Sweden in a 2-3 matchup, and there were three. So, you know, the Finns kind of drew a bad straw there. So I think with the run back eventually, you know, you would think
we hope
that this thing normalizes itself again, but without them, it's a very unique dent in it.
Yeah, and I think it goes to your point of the games being somewhat mediocre in this tournament that just finished, making it a middle of the road as far as the history of the juniors goes. And I think that would help, you know, bump it up and make it more competitive, right?
Yeah, change the dynamics of them not being there, change the whole dynamics of the whole tournament. No, I mean, Dave's exactly right. And I just, people stop killing each other and
yeah,
let's move on and get rid of the, stop killing each other and
change the leadership.
Make it right, you know, get them back over here or where Sweden next year, wherever it's at.
So. Okay, so I have a question. If they built this team to beat Canada, what did they do to try and stop Connor Bedard?
I thought that they had a pretty good plan in place, and the plan was, like many other teams have done, is to defend him from the inside out and make their line defend. And when you're playing against an all-star team versus a regular team in the WHL, which won't have the depth of a World Junior team, mm-hmm. you could throw out any one of probably three lines and even maybe your fourth, and all those lines would be capable of taking Bedard's line and having them probably defend for half a shift as opposed to dominating offensive zone play. So that was, you know, that was obviously a part of it. The possession game was a part of it. The laying pucks behind the defense to make them go 200 feet was a part of it. But I think they had a really good plan to defend from the inside out. And for the most part, like when you look at the U.S.-Canada game, Bedard was not the guy that grabbed the headlines. You know, the goalie was the best player in the game for Canada for sure. And if the goalie is the best player in the game, that means that the opposing team had the puck a lot. So they had a bit of a mission accomplished there. I know Bedard had a couple of points, but I thought Joshua Wall was better in that game than Bedard was. And it's funny because there, if you look back at some of the U.S.-Canada games, a lot of times the U.S. does a pretty good job at handling the star.
Right.
It's the second-tier guy that does great. And that's what happened in that game. But I thought Bedard's a world-class player. Don't get me wrong. I thought the U.S. did a pretty good job on him.
Yeah.
Well,
it reminded me of the job that Cam Fowler did on Taylor Hall in 2010. I mean, Taylor Hall was a non-factor pretty much both of the U.S.-Canada games in 2010. I know he had a couple of points, not a big factor. And I thought he matched up against Fowler, and they were teammates in Windsor. I thought Fowler ate him alive.
Point.
Yeah. When we talked about Russia here a little bit, but I'm going to ask just one more question and then I've got one final one. But how does the tournament improve outside of bringing Russia back?
Lou, stick with me on this one because you're either going to tell me I'm nuts or you're going to say to me, you know what, that's a good idea, but maybe not possible. And here's my idea. You got 10 teams in it now. I'm a little bit tired, and I think the viewing public is a little bit tired of watching some of the bigger federations paste the smaller ones. I can't watch Germany get beat 11-0 anymore.
Yeah.
I can't watch Austria get beat 11-2 anymore. I don't think it helps anybody. So, and that's not a knock on the German or the Austrian federations. They just don't have the depth to compete with some of the other ones. It's not their fault. It's just what it is. So here's my thought. My thought is you have teams that are in that you know of. And like I said, you're going to get the Russians back. So basically, you got five big ones. You're always going to get the Czechs and the Slovaks, who are now back on the rise again. Then you probably get the Swiss, who are always fairly competitive, right? So you got those big five. Then you get the next three. Now you're down to one of the other teams that's going to get in. Is it Latvia? Is it Denmark? Is it, you know, whoever? So you got one more team coming in for nine. The 10th team to me should be the top draft eligibles from all the federations not represented at the World Junior Tournament. It should be a world team of high-end draft-eligible players from every other federation. And I will tell you this. You want to throw American, Canadian, Swiss, Swedes into that are draft-eligible that don't make their World Junior team, put them in there too. Because now all of a sudden, as an NHL scouting staff, you've got one-stop shopping on perhaps 20 to 25 really good prospects for the upcoming draft that you don't have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars traveling all over the world to go see one player. You can now go see them at the World Junior Tournament for seven games against quality competition where you can really make a judgment based on a consistent amount of good viewings. That's my idea to make the tournament better.
I tell you what, I got to give you credit. Ted, tell you what, first of all, I don't like seeing the Germans. I mean, I don't like seeing these teams getting shellacked. I don't want to watch it. Nobody wants to watch it. Nobody is watching it, okay? That being said, as you know, the IIHF, everybody's got a hand in the till. They're all represented, these countries. They want to play in the event, right, obviously. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They don't want to throw some poor sister out, for lack of a better word. They want to be involved. So that you struggle with that, taking teams like that out, because yep, they're part of it. Like, we're on the earth, and there's little countries and there's big countries, right? And some countries are poor, some are rich. So we're all together in humanity, so to speak, right? So when it comes to that, they feel like they're part of it. And so that would be hard but I don't want to watch it. On the thing where you just said, I said, that's thinking outside the box, huh, Julie?
Yeah,
I
mean,
I'll tell you what, it's not a bad idea. Don't think you'll ever see it, because I just think there's too much pride, national pride.
Yeah, but think how awesome it would be if that team of misfits came together and actually won it.
Well,
think about that.
Didn't we have that in the North American? What did we have there a while back in the world?
You had that in the World Cup. We had, like, Team World. You had the top, like, 123 players and that kind of thing. And I think it worked out great. But, Lou, like, here's my other side of it. Like, Seamus Casey this year, and I'm just bringing him up. I have no idea how he feels about this. But Seamus Casey was the eighth defenseman on Team USA, was listed as an emergency player. He didn't play in the tournament. You think Seamus Casey would have a humongous axe to grind playing for Team World against big countries, including his own?
We drafted him.
Yeah.
New Jersey owns his price, okay?
Yep.
So I'm just saying, you're making tons of sense. I hear you. I think people would embrace what you're saying. And I'm not saying I don't like it either. I just don't know if you'll ever see it. But things evolve. Things do change. And I don't want to see teams get beat 11-0. I'm tired of watching that. I don't even watch it.
Did you even watch the national championship, the NCAA football national championship last night with Georgia?
It was awful. I know it was a blowout, but I didn't watch it. But I'm just saying, to that point, to Dave's point, it's a cool idea. I get it. It is a cool idea. I just don't know how open people would be to it, but I hear you. And I don't want to see people the Germans don't want to get beat 11-0.
No.
Really? I mean, I see them play. I don't even watch it. So.
Well, but there's also the thing about, you know, you watch youth hockey, and it does a team good to go play better teams, because then you learn where you are. I mean, I know we're talking cream of the crop here for World Juniors, but having a team of kids come together playing against the higher level competition, it's actually is good for those players too.
Here's the difference. Here lies the need for the World Junior, and I get your point. The difference is this. From a business standpoint, you're a company that's investing thousands of dollars advertising on these games. by the middle of the second period in these games, nobody's watching the games anymore. And it's funny because, I mean, I've done my share of games. I'll share a real quick story. In 2009, the U.S. played Kazakhstan. Matt McConnell was our play-by-play guy. He's now doing play-by-play for Phoenix and or Arizona. And I said to Matt, after watching Kazakhstan play two games at that point, I said, Matt, my guess is Kazakhstan is not going to touch the puck all night. The only guy on this team whose name I'm going to worry about is the goalies. And I guarantee you he's the only guy's name on that team I say all night. And I was right. Because you just knew they were going to lose 14-0, and they did.
You're right about the. It's all about money. It's the average. Like, I'm sure the college football game there, like, people turn off at halftime.
Absolutely, no question.
Earlier for me,
all the money those advertisers spent. Like, let's be honest.
Underdogs make a wonderful story, but they don't move the needle, and that's always the problem when you get a big upset.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of. All American teams or all teams. Are you going to be in Plymouth on Monday night for the BioSteel All-American game, Dave?
I will be in Plymouth on Saturday and Sunday watching my son playing in the NAPHL showcase for the New Jersey Titans at 18U. I will not be there Monday night.
Ah, well, shoot, we're going to be in Chicago this weekend, or I would say let's watch a game together. But yeah, that's going to be a pretty good game Monday night. For sure, and good luck to your son
here. Oh, thanks. I'll tell you, I think we've all learned as parents, like, it's a fun ride when you, no matter what sport your kid's playing or no matter what they're competing, it could be debate club. I mean, it doesn't matter. I just think the thrill of watching your kids grow through competition is awesome, and that's been the fun part for me. I mean, I've had one son who played high school tennis, and that was a joy. And then, you know, I've got Ryan playing 18U, and that's been great. And I think we all feel the same way. You just want to see your kids be happy and compete and, you know, grow up through the game, because the game is a microcosm of life. And the lessons that you pick up, whether it's a team sport, individual sport, no matter what, the things that you pick up coaching this game, playing this game, scouting this game, broadcasting this game, competing in this game, are life lessons that stick with you forever. And the relationships that and friendship that you make along the way are ones that are the most sincere that you'll ever make.
Oh, that's well a said. Great ending. That's perfect. You are spot on, right, Lou?
Yeah, I got a 12-year-old, so I get it. Like,
and look at Lou and I. I mean, Lou and I have been buds. Lou and I met when I first started doing TV. So, like, right around 2006 or so, we were doing the ECAC championships, and I recognized the accent. I didn't know this, but I knew the accent. I said, this guy's got to be from my neck of the woods. We struck up a conversation, stayed friendly, and, you know, then he met my wife, and we would go out because, you know, she's on our broadcast crew, so then the three of us would go out a bit and hang out and chat, and then the Liberty Bell games and that kind of stuff, and, you know, I was scouting when Lou was scouting, and he's become a confidant and a friend and an advisor to me in terms of some things I like to do professional. This game brings together people that are like-minded, who want to share information and get better. And you can't get better unless you rely on people that you feel are smarter than you. And that's how a lot of these friendships get built.
Yeah. There's no recipe. I think that you really have to appreciate good people. It's well said, Dave. It really is. It's special. You're a special friend, and you do a great job. You really do. You're a proud American. And I love the fact, you know what? If somebody said, well, Dave's a little bit U.S. Yeah, that's right. He is. So good. What do you expect him? What do you expect him to root for? The Finns? I mean, like, these people, I tell Joey, like, I hear them talk, well, Starman's kind of a little bit of a homer. Well, I don't know if he's a homer, but I'm glad that he is. I mean, what? Like, who are we rooting for here? We're not rooting for Canada. Okay.
Heck no. I mean, even though we have Canadian friends, we love our listeners in Canada.
I know he's got to be objective and everything, and I the professionalism that comes with it. And I think you're pretty good at being that. But you know what? Like, I don't have a problem. And my mother used to say, we had Gene Hart, obviously everybody knows the Flyers announcer, right, Dave? You know what I mean? For years.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And I once in a while somebody would say, like, you know, he's such a homer. And my mother would say, yeah, the home team pays him. That's how it works.
Yeah. No, Lou, I know you're proud of your time with USA Hockey, and, you know, I was 27 years in, and I love what was accomplished during my time, you know, whether it be coaching education or the ADM or, you know, the goalie development program and the goalie coach development program. And so, I mean, yeah, there are some allegiances that run deep, but you bring up a good point. Like once you get on the air, if you're not 50-50 as a national broadcast, you missed. But when it comes to the U.S. games, I mean, let's think about it. When they're playing the Swedes or the Finns or the Latvians, I mean, the other team has got five or six guys that you're interested in because those might be the guys that got drafted and you're trying to highlight them. On the U.S. team, you got 19 guys that got picked.
Yep.
And so that means you got 19 fan bases that are really intrigued at their player. And if you don't talk about their player, you're doing them a disservice. You got to talk to the fan base because it's the future of the league.
You're doing college hockey. You're totally not even a little bit biased because it's a different animal. I mean, you're an American covering the World Junior for the American audience. I mean, I mean, you know me. I'm a regular guy. Like, I got these wing nuts talking about. Like, really? That's what it is, right? The guy wants, Dave Storyman wants us to win. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Right or wrong? I mean, that's the fact.
Oh, no. Right? Oh, it certainly makes the job easier.
You know, let me just ask you. You don't think Gord Miller wants Canadians to win?
Yeah, good point.
Of course he does.
Totally good point. And I would expect nothing less, to tell you the
truth. Absolutely.
Well, this has just been a great conversation. You have shared a lot with our listeners about, you know, something that moms and dads of squirts and peewees aren't, you know, thinking a whole lot of, but this opens up a whole new world for them. And I appreciate all of the knowledge that you have shared and all of the questions that you've answered. I cannot thank you both enough for joining on Mother Puckers. And the next time we talk, Dave, I want you to introduce me to the person who named the Macon Whoopies. I want to know that person.
I'll leave you with this quick one. It's a quick 30-second story.
Yeah.
I know it was the owner, I think his name was Richard Ray, who was the one who came up with it. And part of it was just a playoff of the song. And in the early 70s in the old Southern Hockey League, there was a team called the Macon Whoopies, you know, ending with an S. So he decided that he wanted to bring back a little bit of that legacy, and he just called it the Macon Whoopie. But the funniest thing is, I got there the first day, and I walk in, and I see the team sweater, and I see the leaf on the front of the jersey, and I thought, Macon Whoopie, how cool is that the team's name is the Macon Whoopie and they got a pot leaf as a logo? And so here's the thing. I hadn't met anybody. I had just driven 16 hours from New York overnight to get there. And so I walk in and I'm in the main office and things are swirling around, whatever. And I said to this guy, this is a pretty cool concept. And he looks at me and goes, no, it's a fig leaf. I didn't know who the guy was. It's a fig leaf. And I said, it looks like a pot leaf to me. And he goes, well, it's a fig leaf because figs are an indigenous to the central Georgia region. I went, oh, okay, sounds pretty good. I said, listen, I think you should go with the pot leaf thing. You're going to sell more jerseys. So he says to me, who are you? I said, hi, I'm Dave Starman. I'm your assistant coach. I said, you are? He goes, I'm Richard Ray. I'm the owner. I went, oh, that was a good start.
Oh, my God.
Hey, I want to say one thing because we, you know, we did get a bronze medal. So, you know, and they're tough games to play in, Dave, right? As you know, Julie, they're hard games to play in.
Yeah.
And the coach, I think Rand, them guys did a great job. And Rand, I know, has been wanting to coach that team for a while. So he's very cool, calm, and collective. I was with the 100th reunion with the Hobie Baker anniversary, and me and Don Cahoon were talking, and I said, you know, Rand doesn't get excited. And he goes, no, he must be inside. He must be churning. That heart must be racing. But you would never know it. But they got bronze. Like, when you can't win gold, you still want to get something. I wish
we come home with hardware. Right?
Yeah, I wish we had gotten a couple more medals in my 5 years I was there, and we didn't. And it means a lot. Those are hard games to play in. And those kids, they don't want to be playing in that game, but you got to gut it out. And it's a credit. We got bronze. Really is.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. And I think, honestly, all the tournaments that we've been in, when we are second, it just hurts harder than winning third for some reason. Second just hurts harder than winning third.
Yeah, I'd
agree.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, hey, I've got going back to Macon Whoopie. Okay, a fig leaf. Okay, wasn't that what Adam and Eve used before the original
sin?
Yeah,
that tied into it too. And,
yeah.
And then when they changed the logo, like they put a whooping cream on it, the bird, and then there was a little bee buzzing around with the bird and the bee. But it just continued to evolve as it went along.
But
the original was the fig leaf, yeah.
I don't think Gary Bettman would go for that.
Yeah.
No, that would be a tough sell, but in Macon, Georgia, I'll tell you what, we sold a lot of gear.
I bet you did. I'm going to go on eBay and I'm going to find a Macon Whoopee jersey for myself now, because that's just brilliant. Yeah. Oh, well, thanks
for
so
a couple thousand bucks for one of my game worn ones that I'll never sell.
Don't sell them. Okay. I won't find yours on there then. That's brilliant. Well, thank you very much for the time, guys. I appreciate it so much. So much entertainment and knowledge share. And hopefully, Dave and Lou, we can have you guys back.
Would love to.
I just enjoyed it, Julie, and thanks for Dave for coming on. That's great. And
absolutely. Well, you travel safe, and okay. Lou, great talking to you as always. And
absolutely, Dave.
Anytime you want to do this again, by all means, let me know.
Okay, awesome. Sounds good, Dave. Good. Thanks, Julie, for everything. Great job.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Dave and Lou. That was so informative. So many new things. I mean, let's make a call to the top brass at USA Hockey and at World Juniors and IIHF, and let's see if we can implement some of these ideas that Dave shared. Really, really thought-provoking and outside of the box. I do want to make one edit. There were not 20 states represented in the 2022 Beijing USA hockey team, but 13. However, growing from four states in 1980 to 13 states in 2022, that's impressive. And I think a lot of that has to do with how youth hockey is growing in these non-traditional markets. And a lot of that comes with when NHL teams win cups, the regions that surround that fan base are going to really see a boon in hockey. I think I talked about in my first season about Dallas and living in Dallas before the Stars were stolen from Minnesota and taken down there. No problems with that. And how there was zero knowledge. And then when the Stars win the cup, it just went nuts down there. And youth hockey just exploded. Same in Chicago. St. Louis has always had strong youth hockey, always. Without a cup, that's how strong and true the St. Louis Blues fans are. LGB, let's go Blues. And then, you know, we just need to get the Preds, and we need to get someone other than the Tampa Bay Lightning to win a game or to win a cup. We need the Panthers. We need the Coyotes. So we need to start bringing some more of that firepower down south so we can explode that youth hockey even more. But thank you very much for listening. And I'm headed off to Park City, as mentioned, and then to Cleveland. So if you're around the Cleveland area, I look forward to seeing you at the rink.